This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are going to be having a conversation about a sense of place and a sense of belonging to a place or a group. Perhaps you are wanting to belong to a group of people who support public broadcasting. Well, today is a great day to join the ranks of the Prairie Public family as a member of this service. What that means is you pick up that phone and call 800-359-4145. You can also text the word donate to 800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. You've probably noticed that we are not airing commercials on this show, Main Street, but what that means is we're not able to raise money by selling commercials. And so instead, we come to you to ask for that support. Click and join at prairiepublic.org, or you can call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145. And today we are going to feature a conversation from the latest One Book, One North Dakota event put on by Humanities ND. And it features three writers talking about a sense of place. Rugby native Mark Vins is a poet and a retired professor and the author of several books, the most recent of which is called The Trouble with Daydreams. Deborah Marquardt is a poet and musician and writer, and she also teaches graduate-level courses at Iowa State University in their MFA program on creative writing. And it also features Pulitzer Prize-winning author Louise Erdrich. She is originally from Wahpeton, and she is an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. She has won a Saul Bellows Award, a National Book Award, and most recently, the Pulitzer Prize. They visit with Teo Basquiat, a professor of philosophy at Bismarck State College.
We have so much to talk about, so let's get into it. Last night, Joe Richardson brought Louise a box of photographs, and in the stories and reminiscences that followed from that as you were unpacking that box, I got to witness sort of the history unfolding of this nascent literary hub in Fargo-Moorhead. And it was so amazing to think how here 30, 40, 50 years later, around this table were award-winning authors, dozens of books between you, countless hundreds, thousands of other writers that you have nurtured. And I think it'd be great for you to take us back into that history again. Take us to that time and place.
Oh my goodness, where to begin? I first just want to say I'm so thrilled to be here with all of you and want to thank Humanities North Dakota for putting this together. And, I could just start by saying that I grew up in Napoleon, North Dakota, and sort of the middle of the state, and I had the choice to go west or east, and I made the decision to go east and came to Moorhead State. And I just think it was my best piece of good luck, and eventually found my way to Mark Vins's classes, the creative writing classes, and the university had this burgeoning theater scene. There was a vibrant music scene, and so I just sort of fell into it, and it nurtured me, and I'm so appreciative of that influence.
Yeah, I came in 1968. I was right out of graduate school, my first job at Moorhead State. The transition from Albuquerque to Fargo was amazing, to say the least. But, when I got here, New Mexico was sort of on the West Coast scene. I mean, we had readings by Lawrence Ferlinghetti and, people like that. And here, it was such a different sense, but a tremendous friendliness and openness and readings going on there were a couple of people, Dick Lyons and Tony Oldknow at North Dakota State. They were putting on readings, and they were gathering writers. And it was a good reading if there were more audience than writers. Concordia did readings. Concordia was on the National Coffee House circuit, so we got to hear some good music, mm-hmm. too. And then Morehead State had Tom McGrath, and he was my mentor, and one of the main reasons I did the things that I did, sort of dedicated to Tom. And there was a tremendous writing community, and in 1971, three students and I founded a poetry magazine that was just sort of one step beyond Mimeocraft. and it actually grew to be nationally distributed, and we really found out what was going on, not just in this immediate region, but especially the Midwest, which was our territory. That's what we really looked for, was exciting Midwestern writers. And there were so many, including Ted Kooser, you know, a future poet. Right. You know, to be good friends with two Pulitzer Prize winners is kind of amazing. but I mean, thinking, you know, Fargo, North Dakota. I lived in Morehead, just across the river. I always thought of it as one community. But what we wanted to do is send some of the writing out, saying, we're here. There's a tremendous energy here. And so the magazine was called Dakota Territory, after the territory of the Lakota in the central part of the country, you know. It just seemed right.
I'm going to return to that flow, but just introduce myself. Anin Nindinwe Makanidok. Hello, my relatives and everyone out there watching. Mekanak Wojiwing Onjibani Mama. Shout out to the Turtle Mountains, people up there, and relatives, and my mother, who is definitely watching. And a thank you to the North Dakota Humanities and to Teo, Iris, Sue, all the people who put this together. I think we're all incredibly fortunate to be in a place where writing, books, education is valued at this level. And so I'm very grateful for that. And I'm very grateful to go back to those early days. So we're talking about 1976, 77. We're going way back. And I walked into Mark's office wanting to work on Dakota Territory. I ended up with Joe Richardson working on a small press distribution scheme that had a book bus. And, you know, so this small press distribution book press bus was going all around to small North Dakota towns, and it was outfitted inside with wonderful little shelves for small press books. And we had all kinds of schemes. Joe Richardson, I grew up with Joe, so that's really why he hired me. I had no potential whatsoever. That's why. It was kind of a Wahpeton nepotism. I'm from Wahpeton, and this was after college. Anyway, so we were working on this, but I want to say that was also the year, 76, 77, when Leonard Peltier was tried in Fargo. Mm-hmm. And I went to that trial every day. Mm-hmm. And it was the beginning for me. So this was also a huge beginning in a different way. It was, I didn't see the evidence. What I saw was fear. What I saw was fear, and then a resultant injustice, because there was no proof. So I couldn't put that together, this fear, and it really influenced the rest of my writing. Really has been devoted in many ways to justice, questions of injustice. But it began with, I think, a sense of acceptance. Mm-hmm. By Mark, and I was published in Dakota Territory, and that meant everything to me. Just to have, I still have my pride of place, Dakota Territory, and you know, really just appreciated the sense of community and there was kind of excitement around it.
I think sense of community, yeah. Because we kept the press going to do chapbooks, little collections, usually first books, and always by people from the region, you know, from Minnesota and the Dakotas. Mm-hmm. That was our focus. Yeah. And that became it. And that's the spirit of the place, you know, helping, opening the door for people. Yes.
This tension that you described too, Louise, this cognitive dissonance between what you knew was right and what you saw going on within the legal system, you know, I think that's that is also the beginning of a life of a writer and an artist, because we enter into that tension and that ambivalence and that ambiguity, and that's where narrative starts to grow, because we, as artists, can go into that space and articulate all of the ironies and the sadnesses and the injustices, because we sort of, as writers, hopefully get good at kind of stopping the world for a second, kind of putting it on a pin, and then getting the reader to go around it to see all of its intricacies and nuances.
I love that, stopping the world for just a pause here, you know.
Pauses are so important for digesting information, right? We are going to pick up that conversation here in just a bit, but a quick pause to let you know how you can support this service.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly, co-host of All Things Considered. We are celebrating some big milestones this year, NPR's 50th year of changing the landscape of radio journalism and non-commercial programming, and four decades of Prairie Public telling North Dakota's fascinating stories. You have the energy sector, a thriving technology and entrepreneurial sector, lots of agriculture, not to mention some pretty intense weather in your part of the world. It is a vast, beautiful place to be. Well, we are honored to help you feel a little more connected to everywhere else with NPR journalists, their unrivaled skill and passion, bringing you closer to the news and sounds and people of the nation and the world. Prairie Public's Dave Thompson and his team of reporters, they have got the regional angle expertly covered. Now, here's how you can help keep the symbiotic relationship going strong. Become a sustaining member of Prairie Public by going to prairiepublic.org, or you can call 800-359-4145. Happy 40th, Prairie Public, happy 50th, NPR, and happy, we hope, first day of your brand new membership.
Thank you, Mary Louise Kelly, just one of the many voices that you tune to for the news programming that you expect to hear out of NPR. We are going to pick up the conversation now on the One Book, One North Dakota event as moderator Teo Basquiat talks with Louise Erdrich about a 1985 article in the New York Times.
It was called Where I Ought to Be, A Writer's Sense of Place. And in there you write, a writer must have a place where he or she feels this, a place to love and be irritated with. And then a little later you say, we cannot abandon our need for reference, identity, or our pull to landscapes that mirror our most intense feelings. And you've all started talking about this already, but I'd like to invite each of you to reflect on that observation. How did you find your way to the places that you write about? And what of them do you love? What are you irritated with?
Oh, what a what there's so much to grab onto there.
Well, I want to read a short piece. John R. Milton.
Yeah.
Taught for many years at the University of South Dakota, and he also founded the South Dakota Review, so he was, like me, an academic, but also a small press person. And he was on the Plains Distribution Magazine Committee. By the way, with the Book Bus, we also sponsored 300 readings and workshops around the region.
Right.
So, yeah. And anyway, this is what John says, and I think it's to me, it's the most important single piece of a writer's response that I have. It is the writers who establish the region's image, not the arguments of local chambers of commerce or any other kind of advertising. No, I agree with that totally. And writers of the past have tended to become romantic or defensive in adopting better side of the picture, or at the opposite pole, they have been gloomy and cynical. It seems to me that our task lies in the tensions between the beautiful and the harsh. We have these extremes. Perhaps they are our only real image. What we need to do now is understand and use the materials of our land. We need to overcome the stereotype meaningfully, not in mere argument. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if I had to do a statement of purpose for my magazine, that's it. You know, it's coming to understand, letting the writers take over doing the image of the place. And it is a mixed relation, as you said. You know, irritation. I say love-hate, you know. Mm-hmm. We've got Sinclair Lewis on one hand and Garrison Keillor on the other.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are writers' range all over the place. And you can't have, if you don't have the loving, you're simply a cynic. If you don't have a healthy set of the irritations, you know, you become an apologist. Mm-hmm. And that opened the door for me, that statement by John. Mm-hmm. Said it for me. And the magazine. Yeah.
I found so many important influences in a book that you and Tom Tamaro edited called Inheriting the Land. And I read the Merida LeSueur essay. She said something like many children of the Midwest, I will never recover from my sparse childhood in Kansas. That was the first time somebody expressed sparse childhood in Kansas. And that was the first time I thought, oh, somebody said it. Thank goodness, you know. And then I felt it was given permission. And Bill Holm wrote this beautiful essay about horizontal grandeur, and I found that, you know, just sort of, he says, you know, we experience the Midwest it's a slow process. We travel over it over the course of days, and it requires a different eye and a different way of appreciating, and that showed me how to love the home a bit more. And, you know, but getting back, Teo, to your question about kind of how we each found our place, the place that is our place that we write about. And for me, it was, I was born there. And I have sort of put my shoulder against it my whole life. But it's also the place that I would fiercely defend if anyone else tried to make fun of it, you know. So, but I fought that for many, many years. And I went to college. And then I got this sort of gift when I was finishing graduate school. And I was trying to figure out where to go after leaving graduate school. I thought, you know, I'll go to someplace really exciting. And then I had this dream, and it involved these tan hills that are just outside of my hometown. It's a glacial moraine. And when I woke up, I didn't know what they were, but I just thought, I have to find these tan hills that are embedded with stones, you know? And I just knew that was where I belonged. And then a couple of years later, on the way home, I took the South Dakota route through to get to home, and I saw the tan hills, and it was the hills leading to Napoleon in this glacial moraine. You know, it's right in front of you as an artist. What you need to know is just right in front of you.
Yeah.
It's so
true. Ted Kooser said that one reason. He has no desire to travel, except, in, you know, around. He's never been to Europe. I mean, you know, that sort of thing. But he says what we need to look for is what's right in front of us, and we overlook. And Paul Grucco said the same thing. It's writing is in a large sense a matter of seeing. And if we don't get out of the car, there's so many people say the Midwest is the flyover, you know. Well, if you don't really get out, as Bill says, he said, there's a universe. Take a square foot of prairie and there's a universe there.
Yeah.
Learn the names of things, you know, which is what I had a good friend who was head of a state park, Buffalo River State Park, just outside of Moorhead. And he took me on the prairie with Paul Grucco. Mm. And they taught me the names of things. They'd say, eat this, you know. And, okay. And it was Novocaine. I couldn't talk. He said, yeah, the Indians used to use that. They call it Indian Novocaine.
Still using it.
They are still using it.
Oh, yes.
Goodness.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, I mean, that's it. You know, and I was lucky because I had guides. You know, and that's part of the people who lived here, the people whose energy is here, you know, from the Prairie People to Tom McGrath to Bill Holm, who was with me at the University of Kansas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Well, I've been so fortunate all my life because I feel like we're talking about two things. Family. I felt so grounded in my family all my life. And place. And to me, those two, those are together, and tribal connections. So I have this, these layers of love and commitment, and as you say, sometimes difficulties, of course. But so my mother, who is Turtle Mountain Chippewa, French High Mom, and again, and my father, who was German American, really gave us so much in terms of security and purpose and really a literary influence. So we had an amazing library in Wahpeton. My parents were school teachers, my mother an artist. And we grew up valuing these things. And my mother helped me leave to go to college. And it took me a long time to get back. I got as close as Minneapolis so I could get here in under 4 hours. And 94 is an old trade route. It's a native trade route. So I feel like I'm getting back to Wahpeton by a very old means. Anyway, in terms of place, I have this feeling once I hit Sauk Center that the sky really opens up and that, you know, people come into the flat area of the Red River Valley right after Fergus Falls and you suddenly see this astonishing sight. Is all sky, really. And that, to me, has always been the most beautiful sight in the world. I've always found that because of growing up on the edge of Wahpeton and seeing horizon and seeing, at the time, I was seeing a lot of grass, margins of grass and ditches and along fields. I always found that when I left, there was something enclosing and constricting about life without the horizon. And I still feel that I need to come back. And fortunately now I'm able to come back a lot. And I feel that the various landscapes we grow up in really get into us. I love the way you said about your dreams. Your dreams are filled with these.
You're listening to a conversation from the recent One Book, One North Dakota online event from Humanities ND. It features writers Deborah Marquardt, Louise Erdrich, and Mark Vins. We'll have more of that conversation after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The infrastructure bill moving through Congress includes billions of dollars to modernize the electric grid. Harvest Public Media's Seth Bodine reports one of the goals is to make the system less vulnerable during severe weather.
The bill includes $73 billion to modernize the electric grid. U.S. Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm says the money could be used to move power lines underground so they would be less susceptible to severe weather. Granholm says other countries are already doing it.
There's a lot of effort of undergrounding distribution and transmission wires where you can put soil over the top and just farm on top of it and have the farmer compensated for this line that goes underneath the ground that you can't even see.
Chris Myers, the general manager for the Oklahoma Association of Electric Cooperatives, says it's too expensive to put power lines underground without government help. The $1 trillion bill is still awaiting a vote in the House. Seth Bodine, Harvest Public Media.
Natural gas prices are high right now. State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helm says the price is now over $4 per million cubic feet of natural gas. He says Hurricane Ida is the cause.
It really took a huge amount of natural gas production in the Gulf of Mexico offline.
Helms also says gas storage is down, and he says there's a high demand for liquid natural gas in Europe, which is used for electric generation.
What that means, of course, is that, you know, all that talk that we had a year ago or 2 years ago about net negative on ethane and methane and all the ains were pains a year to a year and a half ago, but no longer. They're all highly profitable at this point.
Helm says one new gas processing plant is coming online, another has expanded, and there is at least another plant on the drawing board in western North Dakota. And a $1 trillion infrastructure bill now pending in the U.S. House is being watched carefully in Minnesota. The bill has already cleared the Senate, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has promised to bring it to the floor for a vote next week. Minnesota State Senator Tom Bach, who is an independent but allied with the Minnesota GOP, chairs a committee that crafts construction project bills. A bonding bill will be a focus of the 2022 legislative session.
You know, Obama talked about doing a big infrastructure bill. Trump talked about doing one. Never happened. Now Biden's talking about it. I wouldn't bet money it's going to happen. But if it did, it would definitely would take some pressure off of our road and bridge funding.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are in our fall member drive. It is New Member Monday. We are looking at picking up new members and saying welcome to the Prairie Public family. You can become an investor in this service at prairiepublic.org or by picking up that phone and calling or texting the word donate to 800-359-4145. Today, we are airing a conversation from the recent One Book, One North Dakota online event about a sense of a place. As author and poet Deborah Marquardt, Pulitzer Prize winning author Louise Erdrich, and poet Mark Vins speak with Theo Basquiat, a professor of philosophy at Bismarck State College.
I used to give a writing assignment to my freshman classes, to when we were still on quarter systems, and so they were home for Christmas for 3 weeks. And I said, I want you to talk to your parents. And I gave them a whole list of things to find out and then pick one to write on. Like, where does your name come from? Most of them had no idea. Mm-hmm. Is there a cemetery near where your relatives are buried? Most of them hadn't been there.
Mm-hmm. That's a great assignment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there was a writer named William Goyen. He was a fiction writer, but he did a wonderful piece. He was writer in residence at Princeton, and he said his students, he'd give them the same sort of assignment. They wrote about their room, or their bed. That was their sense of place. He said, "Isn't there anything? A tree? Isn't there something?" And he said, "No."
Well, just the fact that you gave that assignment, so that. That changes things. That's like a game changer for young people, I think. When you have someone who says, this is what's valuable.
Right.
Yeah.
And that grew into eventually a Midwestern Lit course, where I could do more of that. I opened the course with Ole Rolvag, with Giants in the Earth.
Oh,
one view.
Great book.
The
yeah.
second book was Tracks, your boy.
Oh.
So they went from these two extremely different, sort of experiences. Right. It wasn't the... What the Norwegians went through, it was what the tribal people went through as they were being destroyed.
There's layers, right?
Yeah.
So there's loss, there's dispossession in every, like the 80s, dispossession and farms up for foreclosure all through the Dakotas.
And the other thing, it's related, Jane Smiley's book, 1,000 Acres,
right,
where the farms are all being taken over by huge corporations.
Yep. And we've seen that too. Yeah.
And the last part of the book, she goes back to her hometown, and there are no more family farms. Everything has totally changed.
Right.
Walmart has taken over. This is long even before Amazon, so you have to think how much worse it's getting.
Oh, yeah, I mean.
And that was what Davidson predicted, Donald Davidson predicted. That the national culture is developing, but it's not the culture that's going to support the arts.
I think what he was talking about, too, I think he was talking about the most extreme form of capitalism.
Yes.
In which which steamrolls regional differences.
Yeah.
It's like lasering the land to have a flat surface.
Well, there's a lot been written about the big chain stores moving into town and putting the local hardware store out of business.
Wahpeton. We have a wonderful downtown
yeah.
struggling with a Walmart yeah. on the outskirts.
So many towns you go through, there.
Yeah.
Boarded up.
Well, you know, this gets into a whole other line of.
I do want to put in a word, though, for virtual space, because I think that, you know, not to completely dismiss the virtual space as a place that can be cultivated as a valid place to exist, to dream, to imagine, to travel, to explore, to connect, to learn. And I think that, you know, I see with my students that this is a real environment. I mean, it's a virtual environment, online, all of social media and things like that. But it's a valid form of placeness. It's completely different than what we know to be place. Mm-hmm. But I think it is valid form. And I've seen writers write brilliantly into those spaces. And then I also think about, you know, we've got this great science fiction, you know, tradition of science fiction writers, fantasy writers now that are writing. And they are creating these incredible imaginative worlds. So I just want to put in a bid for that as an idea of place to be cultivated, too.
We're waiting for your essay.
Yeah, I will.
I can't wait to read this.
No, I didn't mean to put it down.
I
wouldn't say it's not valid. I'm just saying that it's the culture is changing, and I'm afraid for what's being lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I agree. Speaking of the lost part, you all are speaking to a real complex, nuanced sense of place and paying attention to those things, which strikes me as being really different than, like, nostalgia.
Oh, yeah.
How have you seen that kind of play out in the work that you've done with this place?
There's one thing I do really have nostalgia for.
Yeah.
It's the Western Meadowlark. The Meadowlark.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is what grips me when I come home. The loss of a diverse biosphere. That's a fancy way of saying birds and bugs and, you know, grasses and everything that that really spoke to me as a child, and really had to do. I grew up at a time when we had a more diverse farm system, fewer chemicals, fewer pesticides and herbicides, and a meadowlark on every fifth or tenth fence post. My dad sent a letter to me counting the meadowlarks as he rode by in a bus. They were continual. As you got to the edge of town, you would always hear them. And now I have to go to, I think we heard some at Tea Walken this spring, and my heart just gets inside you, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have them probably. There's more diverse bird life where you are, but that I do have real true, I think, nostalgia for that.
But there we are at the loss again, though.
Yes.
Like the
it's all
something
mixed up
that
with
also
loss.
Just brings your heart right to home, but also is blended with this loss, and it seems like the stories that you all tell, the poems that you write, are really, they don't back away from that tension. It keeps us right there in this place is more complicated than people would want to say that it is. That you're overlooking, you're not paying attention to something that you all, through your stories, are directing our attention to.
Well, you know, I was thinking when you asked the question about Eliot's, you know, April is the cruelest month, which most people know that line, but they don't realize that two lines later is the line mixing memory and desire. Mm-hmm. And the way I've always thought about that is I'm largely have been a writer of memory because I don't have enough imagination to make things up. So I just remember what happened and then I try to figure out what's resonant or interesting about the thing that happened. But I'm trying to cultivate a sense of being a writer of desire. And so this idea of desire in language, right? So we write our way into the world, toward our desires, and our words go out and they make the world the way that we imagine it to be or perhaps want it to be. And so I think this is the job of writers, right? You know, we're writers of memory, but we're also writers of desire. We write for the past, but we also write for into the future. And we have many examples of writers who have written important books, you know, The Jungle, you know, I mean, there are many examples of works of literary works that have changed cultures, that have changed ways of thinking, mm-hmm. that have changed the future. And so I always try to think that way about my own practice as a writer.
Yeah.
Stegner talks about nostalgia in the terms of longing for a place that we never had. You know, go out and find the real place, not the one you think you have. Yeah. That involves nuance and mm-hmm. doing some work and so on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He also said, a place isn't a place till it has a poet.
Oh, that's good.
Chambers of Commerce, they need to take note of that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't want to talk into either or terms or put down, you know. It's just like my place isn't any better than anybody else's place. I mean, this is, I'm not going to say hold up the Midwest. I think it has to be held up more than most, however, simply because people don't know it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But this is not a contest. And so many people have said, William Stafford said, in terms of regionalism, he said, regionalism is any writer that lives outside of New York, Los Angeles.
It's true. I mean, you know, we get so many writers in Brooklyn, and you read so much about Brooklyn, but does anybody say I'm a regionalist?
But isn't it a region?
But that
it has its own values, it has its own accents. And,
right, it has its own world, its own life. So I think I think every writer is a regionalist.
Yeah,
but I do think because we don't have the population of the coasts that we have to hold up our writing world and we have to. You've done this all your life, and you're doing this,
I tell you, you mentioned Scott Russell Sanders. I think he is the most profound writer in the Midwest.
I've
read everything. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I agree. And we have, I don't mean, the agrarians were crusaders. I'm not asking for a crusade. No, that's about the last thing we need. We have too many crusaders in this world, you know.
What do we need?
Awareness.
What would we need to nurture the literary community of this region?
Things like we're doing right now.
What else?
Well, I started out with a very strong, as a poet in the schools, a really strong poet in the schools. Doesn't have to be poet, writer, whoever, but bringing writers into the school systems, but strengthening, before all else, school systems. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, I feel like as the daughter of school teachers and with a daughter who is a school teacher, this is one of the most profound things we have to do is this is valuing preschool through elementary, through high school education in our country and bringing it back to be a true public system, mm-hmm. to really bring it back to a system in which everybody has a fair chance at getting a great education. So, and into the college system. You know, this is where we should be throwing the money and into the humanities.
and to give young people who have this special set of skills that, you know, maybe they're not that great in sports, right? But, you know, and maybe they don't want to be cheerleaders and maybe they don't want to even run the school newspaper, but maybe they are great singers or they love to write. And so often in school budgets, the first thing that's cut is the art teacher, you know, and I don't think there are that many high schools that have creative writing teachers. They'll have literature teachers who will teach writing probably. But, you know, it seems like it's a shame that we don't have programming within schools that allows, you know, the support of kids that have all those creative arts kind of going on in their souls.
Let me ask you each to put a fine point on it. Like, what's at stake if we don't? Like, what if these stories don't get told? What if we don't nurture this? What's really at stake?
You know, I always look at the first people when we look at a country being taken over and a country being put under authoritarian rule. Who do they go after the first? It's the poets.
It's the poets.
It's the poets. Why?
Why?
Because there's something about the freedom to speak to the heart. And that's what I think we would lose. We would lose the ability to connect with another consciousness in the privacy of your own special place, whether it's a hammock in the backyard or the porch or the middle of a, you know, prairie scene. You know, it's this private communion with another consciousness. That's what writing is. And the ability of a writer to reach in and reach out of themselves, of ourselves, and reach into another heart. That's why it's really a frightening thing to people who want to keep other people under lock and key.
Stories do, I think, help us navigate these differences. When you have a couple of stories that come into conflict with one another in the same place, helps us cope with loss, helps us make meaning and understand our world. And it seems like without that, what else helps us do that work in the world? Our very humanity seems to me to be at stake in this. Like, stakes are very high.
And I really feel like we need this. We need to be we need to understand one another. We need to have a way in to other people's mindsets, their thoughts, their feelings. Something that is not mediated through a screen exactly, but through a giant corporate profit-making machine, which would be a news program or a continual news program or something that is giving us a lot of other people's opinions. We just need to hear a story, see a story, read a story, and make up our own minds.
And I have faith, actually, in the creative force of people, even in the face of privation, that, you know, they will find creative ways to express. I grew up around wonderful storytellers. You know, we would sit around the table, and we didn't put the food away. We'd just sit and sort of sit back, and my dad would tell stories, and that was kind of where I learned storytelling and creativity. And, you know, he was a farmer. I mean, and he was a son of a farmer, but they had a way of creating entertainments, and they had all kinds of stories about people in the town, and, you know, and so extremely creative people, you know.
Yeah.
I think what we're talking about is building new layers of acknowledgement and support and supporting artists so that they can become, you know, more accomplished and that they can do something for a living rather than do it on the side. You know, make a living doing this, but then sort of at night, stay up half the night working on a novel or a poem. And so, you know, we're fortunate to live in a country where we have a great deal of, you know, we have got a lot of resources in this country. So I think what we're talking about is maybe reallocation of some resources so that we can support that part of us. You know, I mean, as William Carlos Williams said, you know, it's hard to get the news from poems, but one, you know, men die miserably every day from lack of what is found there, and that nutrition is what is found there in the stories, in the novels.
Yeah.
Speaking of stories, what stories other than your own, what books do we need to be reading right now? And as North Dakotans, what would you recommend?
Okay,
give you each one.
As a bookseller, I'm just going to grab onto this. I know I'm going to recommend this, which I'm reading. It's Clay Jenkinson's latest essays on the future of North Dakota. The last one about cottonwoods, wonderful. This is a wonderful book. All right.
I would recommend Scott Russell Sanders' Writing from the Center.
Yeah.
Yeah, writing from the center. And he's got many essays. He's got a history of writing in the Midwest and all kinds of really provocative thinking about things like regionalism and place. And what he says is it's like we're all on the same stream. We just don't know it. You know, reach out and you can touch somebody, but we just, you know, we're trained to look the other direction.
Oh, Teo, this is so cruel. But, the book that comes to mind that I've read in the last year and a half that I loved so much was John Blumley's, and I may be pronouncing his last name incorrectly, Blumley. He was a state geologist in North Dakota, and NDSU Press just published his book, The Geology of North Dakota. And he talks about being the state geologist, and his first assignment was to come out and go where they had dug the caverns for the ICBMs. And before they put the missiles in, six stories deep, and he was able as a geologist to go down and stand in the pit of that huge cavern and see all the layers of geology. And for me, geology is just endlessly fascinating. So I would recommend that book.
Terrific.
Wow.
I just want to express how grateful I am to all of you for the work that you have poured into telling these stories, bringing our attention to these places, helping us connect with each other and where we live, and putting you on the spot, Louise, would you like to, is there a way that you say goodbye in Ojibwe?
Well, you know, there's no goodbyes in Ojibwe.
Okay.
It's Gigawabaman.
Which means?
I will see you. I'll see you.
I like that.
I'll be seeing you.
We'll be seeing you.
Yeah.
And the voices you heard in that One Book, One North Dakota event about a sense of a place. Author, poet, musician, and educator Deborah Marquardt. She is the author of several books, including most recently, The Night We Landed on the Moon. She teaches several graduate-level courses in the MFA program of creative writing at Iowa State University. She's originally from Napoleon, North Dakota. Mark Vins is a poet and the author of several books, including most recently The Trouble with Daydreams. You can search the Main Street Archives for a conversation about that book. He is a retired professor from MSUM, originally from Rugby. And Louise Erdrich. She is from Wahpeton. She is an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. She is the author of a couple dozen novels, books of poetry, and children's books. She has won a Saul Bellows Award, a National Book Award, and most recently, the Pulitzer Prize. They were visiting with Teo Basquiat, a professor of philosophy at Bismarck State College. And that's the kind of programming that you can expect on a show like Main Street, where we like to take deep dives into great ideas. Like, what does it mean to be from somewhere? How does that impact our writing, our way of thinking, our way of living? Now, most of the time we're doing those conversations ourselves, but we have this great partnership with places like the Arts Council and Humanities ND. This event came to us from Humanities ND. We love hearing from different kinds of people from across the state. Teo Basquiat, I thought, just did a wonderful job moderating that conversation, really putting a lovely philosophical spin on a topic like a sense of place. If you appreciate that kind of programming, please support it now by going online to prairiepublic.org or by calling or texting the word donate to 800-359-4145.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 20th. In 1889, Louis Peterson opened the Pacific Hotel in Bismarck. He named it in honor of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Only 3 years later, Peterson died. Henry Tatley acquired the hotel when he married Peterson's widow in 1897. The original hotel was a wooden building, but in 1906, Tatley added a brick structure at the corner of 4th Street and Broadway at the cost of $60,000, the equivalent of nearly $2 million today. Renamed the Grand Pacific Hotel, it was marketed as a first-class establishment. It added 60 new rooms. 20 of these had private bathrooms, which was unusual in a time when most hotels had shared bathrooms on each floor. The building also housed a billiard room, a bowling alley, and a cafe. The barbershop was touted as the finest in the city, complete with a Turkish bath. In 1912, Tatley closed the original wooden portion that had been the Pacific Hotel to replace it with a four-story brick addition to the 1906 structure. On this date, in 1912, workers hurried to finish the new addition. They faced the pressure of an important deadline. In less than a month, the second annual industrial exposition was due to open in Bismarck. Henry Tatley assured the public that the new dining room would be opened in time. The hotel would also boast many new rooms for the expected visitors. Only 3 years later, in 1915, the Grand Pacific Hotel was badly damaged by fire. This required an extensive renovation. This updated structure was promoted as a first-class, medium-priced hotel with all the features of better-class houses. The hotel remained prosperous through the 1950s, advertised as the best hotel in the city, but it began to decline in the 60s. The completion of the interstate had caused a major shift in traffic. There was also increased competition from modern hotels and a decline in Bismarck's downtown area. Those forces led to the closure of the Grand Pacific Hotel in 1973, and the building was demolished the following year. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
One last moment on this Monday edition of Main Street to let you know about your opportunity to support all of the great conversations that you hear on Main Street and, of course, the news that you hear all day, the great entertainment programs that happen on the weekends, and the music programming from Scott Prebis and Mike Olson. 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org. Coming up tomorrow on Main Street, climate crisis and our health. An excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.